I'm not going to do a whole lot more than read this tonight. For this introductory section of the course, I want to do that with the handout because some of this is a bit complex. And I thought it'd probably be easier for you to have it in written form than to try to take notes of. When we get into the Book of Kings itself and the content, I'm not going to do that. It'd just be a lecture and you'll have to rely on your own note-taking. But for this introductory material, I gave you the handout. First thing I want to discuss is name. The Hebrew title is Malachim, which is kings. There's no evidence that the book was divided into two parts in the Hebrew text until the edition of the Hebrew Bible published by Daniel Bomberg, 1516-1517 in Venice. The division of the book into two parts was introduced by the Septuagint, that's the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which combined Kings and Samuel into one great history work entitled 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Book of Reigns, or Kingdoms, Basileion. Jerome altered this in the Vulgate to 1, 2, 3, 4 Kings. The division of the material into two parts has continued to the present in both Hebrew and modern language editions of the Bible. I think that's something worth knowing, particularly you see that reference to 1, 2, 3, 4 Kings, which was the title used by Jerome in the Vulgate. In Roman Catholic tradition, those titles are still used. So you may look up a commentary, or it may come across in your reading sometimes a reference, say, to 3rd Kings, and wonder what it is. 3rd Kings would be the same as our 1st Kings. Because you see, in the Vulgate, Samuel was called 1st and 2nd Kings, and then Kings is called 3rd and 4th Kings. Because in the Vulgate, Samuel and Kings were sort of viewed as a unit, 1, 2, 3, 4. In Hebrew tradition, the books of Samuel are called Samuel and Kings called Kings. And that's what we follow. But originally, both those books were one unit. There's one book of Samuel, one book of Kings. The division into two was originally done in the Septuagint, but then via the Septuagint came back into these later editions of the Hebrew text, so that in our present Hebrew text you get two books of Kings, two books of Samuel. But that really was not original. All right, it's clear, however, that the material of the two books constitutes an original unity. The division occurs at a rather arbitrary, although appropriate place after the deaths of Ahab in 2237 and Jehoshaphat in 2250. Now, Ahab was a king in the north, Jehoshaphat a king in the south. You get the deaths of two major kings right in that last chapter of 1 Kings. So it's an appropriate place. But it lets the account of the reign of Ahaziah of Israel, that's 2251-53, overlap the end of 1 Kings and the beginning of 2 Kings. The same is true with Elijah, whose life is narrated in 1 Kings, but his translation is narrated in 2 Kings. So the division is somewhat arbitrary, but at a reasonably appropriate place. When taken as a unit, the book assumes a well-defined place in the Old Testament canon among the former prophets. The former prophets, that's traditional Jewish nomenclature or designation for what we usually call the historical books. But the former prophets, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, together describe the history of pre-exilic Israel and Canaan. They begin after the death of Moses and end with the death of Nebuchadnezzar, succeeded by Evil-Merodach, who brought Israel's independence to an end. Kings describes the end of David's rule, the United Kingdom under Solomon, and the divided kingdom in its entirety. All right, B is general content. Kings describes the last period of the history of pre-exilic Israel. It begins with the death of David and divides naturally into three major sections. Three sections are 1 Kings 1 to 11, a description of the rule of Solomon, under whom the kingdoms of Israel and Judah are united. Secondly, 1 Kings 12 through 2 Kings 17 give the history of the divided kingdom until the downfall of Israel, that is the northern kingdom, the capture of Samaria by the Assyrians. That runs from 1 Kings 12 to 2 Kings 17. Second major section. Third is 2 Kings 18 to 25, where you have the kingdom of Judah until the destruction of Jerusalem, with two supplements concerning Gedaliah, 2 Kings 25, 22 to 26, and Jehoiachin, 2 Kings 25, 27 to 30. Now, when I say the kingdom of Judah until the destruction of Jerusalem, that is the kingdom of Judah subsequent to the fall of Samaria in the north, on to the end. So from 721, 722 down to 586. So those are the three major sections. In the second section, the history of the two kingdoms is not given in separate narratives, but rather in a parallel fashion. Beginning with Jeroboam first, the technique utilized is to describe the reign and activities of a certain king and then move to all the kings in the other kingdom who were contemporary with it, and then work back and forth that way. The composition of the book is characterized by the setting of the description of each king in the framework of introductory and concluding formulae. The introductory formula usually contains following six elements: age at accession, length of reign, place of rule, mother's name, assessment of the reign, and synchronization. That is, he began to reign in the such and such year of a king in the other kingdom. Synchronizes it with that. The concluding formula usually contains a supplemental source. You know, the rest of the acts of so-and-so can be read in some other place. A death announcement, place of burial, name of successor. An example of this framework is found with Rehoboam in 1 Kings 14:21. He was 41 years old when he became king. He reigned 17 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Naamah. She was an Ammonite. In 14:29 to 31, you read, as for the other events of Rehoboam's reign and all he did, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Judah? And Rehoboam rested with his fathers and was buried with them in the city of David. And Abijah, his son, succeeded him as king. You see, those kinds of formulas at the beginning and the end of the reign, pretty standard all the way through for each of the kings. They don't all contain all those elements, but usually they contain a pretty good number of them. Beginning with Abijah, another element is introduced into the introductory formula, namely that of synchronization with the ruler of the other kingdom. 1 Kings 15:1. Abijah, you see, is the second king in the south. Rehoboam was the first, then Abijah, then Asa. So, of Abijah it says, in the 18th year of the reign of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, Abijah became king of Judah. So that's your first synchronization. Jeroboam was the first king in the north. In the 18th year of his reign, Abijah begins to reign in the south. With Nadab, 1 Kings 15:28, and Elah, 1 Kings 16:10, the year of death is also synchronized. The most important element in the introductory and concluding formula, however, is the judgment or evaluation of the king according to the criterion as to whether or not he was faithful to the Lord and the covenant or fell into idolatry. Because the kings of Israel, that is the northern kingdom, all participated in the calf worship at Bethel and Dan, they are all said to have walked in the way of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. 1 Kings 15:34. Only with Joram, 2 Kings 3:2, and Hoshea, 2 Kings 17:2, does the judgment include some commendation. So you see, with the northern kings, because right after the division of the kingdom, Jeroboam set up those calves at Bethel and Dan. With those northern kings, all of them walked in the way of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. The assessment of the kings of Judah is somewhat more nuanced, but even when in general there are things in their activities which meet approval, there remains the fact that they have not removed the high places. Unqualified praise is given only to Hezekiah and Josiah. 2 Kings 18:3 and 4, 2 Kings 22:2 and 23:8. Five kings are given qualified approval: Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoash, Azariah, and Jotham. With those five kings, it says they were basically good kings, but they didn't remove the high places. So there's that qualification. If we look those texts up, we would see that. The strongest disapproval is given to Ahab, the northern king, 1 Kings 16:29 to 34, and Manasseh in the south, 2 Kings 21. All right, it's a little after 8. We should take a break here. Let's take about 10 minutes. We'll pick up here about 12 after. That the formulae that introduce and conclude the description of the reigns of the various kings. Last paragraph. It is generally accepted that these framework formulae are the work of the author himself, even though he may have gleaned the details of the information contained in them from the archives of the court. Difference of opinion exists, however, with respect to the time of their origin. Martin Noth, Überlieferungs Geschichtliche Studien, Halle, 1943. That's traditions, historical studies, traditions, history studies, by Martin Noth. English translation of Deuteronomistic History. That was translated in 1981, but it's a very influential writing. Martin Oath suggests that these introductory and concluding formulae are the latest material in the Book of Kings and constitute the final framework in which earlier material was set. On the other hand, Alfred Jepson, The Sources of the Books of Kings, 1956, adopts exactly the opposite standpoint. He says the framework material is the oldest material of the present Book of Kings, stemming from what he designates as the synchronistic chronicle of Israel and Judah, including material from the annals of both kingdoms. He ascribes its composition to a priest living at about the end of the divided kingdom period. This provided the structure within which later editors inserted all sorts of material from other sources. Jepson regards the chronicle as the core of the present Book of Kings, containing in condensed form the history of both kingdoms till the time of Hezekiah. More detailed discussion of this would take us too far astray. I don't want to get too much involved in that kind of thing. When we look closer at the first major division, 1 Kings 1 to 11, we find it divides into introductory material, chapters 1 and 2, and a conclusion, chapter 11. Between these two sections, chapters 3 to 10 center on A, Solomon's wisdom, chapters 3 and 4, B, his building of the temple and his palace, chapters 5 to 9, and C, his prosperity and wealth, chapter 10. The reader notices immediately that the author has arranged his material to place the dark side of Solomon's life and activities in the final chapter. This arrangement, in not strictly chronological, is not, that should be is not instead of in not, as can be seen especially by 11, 14, and 25, which for the most part refer to events much earlier than the preceding and following verses. So that's the structure of that first section. That goes back, you see, to the first section. It's at the bottom of page 1, 1 Kings 1 to 11. The second major division, 1 Kings 12 to 2 Kings 17 contains the history of the divided kingdom period. This runs from the death of Solomon to the fall of Samaria. This is by far the largest of the three sections. Division of this material into, I should say, subsections is much more difficult than with the material relating to the reign of Solomon. In the first section, there is one king and about a 40-year period of history. The second major division, 1 Kings 12 to 2 Kings 17, contains the history of the divided kingdom period from Solomon's death until the fall of Samaria. I've got a duplication here. That must have happened on my computer somehow. This is by far the largest of the three sections. Division of the material into subsections is much more difficult than with material relating to the reign of Solomon. In the first section, there's one king, 40-year period. Now, here's where that's duplicated up to that point. That can be eliminated. In the second section, there are numerous kings in the two kingdoms and more than 200 years of history. In only one instance is there simultaneous succession in the two kingdoms, namely when Joram of Israel and Ahaziah of Judah were killed on the same day by Jehu, 2 Kings 9, 21 to 28. The revolution of Jehu thus provides one major point of division for this section, 2 Kings 9. See the outline sections 2 and 3. The question is how to divide the material further. Here's something quite different calls for our attention. In a great deal of the remaining material, the prophets Elijah and Elisha assume a predominant place. These two men provide points of orientation for many of the narratives. The time of Elijah begins with 1 Kings 17:1 and the time of Elisha with 2 Kings 2:1. This then gives us three major points of orientation for 1 Kings 12 to 2 Kings 7. 1, 1 Kings 17, Elijah, 2, 2 Kings 2, Elisha, 3, 2 Kings 9, Jehu. That should be 1 Kings 12 to 2 Kings 17, not 7. See, just above that 1, 1 Kings 17, Elijah. In other words, the second major section of the book, which runs from 1 Kings 12 to 2 Kings 17, to try to break that down is kind of hard because of all this synchronization of rules, kings in the north, kings in the south. But I think it's kind of three pegs, you might say, you can hang something on. 1 Kings 17 is Elijah. 2 Kings 2 is Elisha. And 2 Kings 9 is Jehu. And Jehu is a significant figure. So they give you some sort of major dividing points. With respect to the period prior to Elijah, an appropriate dividing point is the conclusion of 1 Kings 14. Chapters 12 to 14 handle the history of Jeroboam 1 and Rehoboam, the first two rulers of the divided kingdom. Chapters 15 to 16 handle both of their successors up to the time of the first appearance of Elijah. Chapters 17 to 19 have Elijah as their center of focus. Chapters 20 to 2 Kings 1 contain stories of Elijah, interspersed with stories of Ahab's wars and the Syrians of Damascus. 2 Kings 2 to 8 centered around the ministry of Elisha. 2 Kings 9 to 10 describe the revolution of Jehu. 2 Kings 11 to 14 deal with the reigns of Joash and Amaziah of Judah and the contemporaneous kings in Israel. 2 Kings 15 to 17 deal with the last days of the northern kingdom with the contemporaneous kings in Judah, Jotham and Ahaz. Then the final major section, 2 Kings 18 to 25, concerns the final days of the kingdom of Judah, beginning with the reign of Hezekiah and including the significant reigns of Manasseh and Josiah. Okay, so much on general content. That gives you some idea of the material that's covered in 1st and 2nd Kings. C is authorship and sources. First, authorship. The question of who wrote 1st and 2nd Kings has long been a matter of discussion. with little solid evidence to provide a basis for reaching a firm conclusion. In the Mishnah, Jeremiah is credited with the authorship of 1 and 2 Kings. Although this is not impossible, it seems highly unlikely. Few, if any, modern scholars accept this as a reliable tradition, although Gleason Archer, in his introduction, regards it as possible that Jeremiah was the author of all but the last chapter, which is interesting.
Would he be the compiler?
Yeah, whoever wrote it had to have sources at his disposal that he utilized to compile. So sometimes you speak of an author editor on most of Kings. The last event in Kings is the death of Jehoiachin, 2 Kings 25, 29 to 35, or 29 and 30. While his death is not explicitly mentioned, the text speaks of provision at the king's table as long as he lived. How long he lived, we do not know. We do know that Jehoiachin was released from prison in the 37th year of the exile, in the year Evil-Merodach succeeded Nebuchadnezzar as king in Babylon, which is 562 BC, or about 25 years after the fall of Jerusalem, 2 Kings 25, 27. If you look at 2 Kings 25, 27, you read, in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiachin, king of Judah, in the year of Evil-Merodach, became king of Babylon, he released Jehoiachin from prison. On the 27th day of the 12th month, he spoke kindly to him, gave him a seat of honor higher than those of the other kings who were with him in Babylon. So Jehoiachin put aside his prison clothes for the rest of his life, ate regularly at the king's table. Day by day, the king gave Jehoiachin a regular allowance as long as he lived. Now, that's the 37th year of the exile, 562 BC. We also know that Jeremiah was called to be a prophet in the 13th year of King Josiah, Jeremiah 1:2. You read there, the word of the Lord came to him in the 13th year of the reign of Josiah. That's Jeremiah 1:2, son of Ammon, king of Judah. When he was still very young, Jeremiah says, I'm only a child, in Jeremiah 1:6. Josiah began to reign in 640 BC. If we assume that Jeremiah was 20 years old when he was called to be a prophet, then at the time of Jehoiachin's release, he would have been 85 years old. See, 640 BC, Josiah, 627, the 13th year, 647, the birth of Jeremiah. That's the 13th year of Josiah. If he was 20 years old, then you see his birth would have been at 647. And if you compare 647 with 562, which is the year of the accession of Evil-Merodach, that would have made Jeremiah 85 years old at the point in time that Jehoiachin was released. If we add five more years of time in which Jehoiachin enjoyed his new status, being released there in prison, we come to about 90 years of age for Jeremiah. While it's not impossible for Jeremiah to have lived this long and written 1 and 2 Kings, it's not seen likely for various reasons. First, E.J. Young points this out in his introduction, page 188. It seems likely that the account of the deportation and imprisonment of Jehoiachin was written in Babylon. But Jeremiah was taken to Egypt. Remember, after Jerusalem was taken, Jeremiah went to Egypt. Jeremiah 43, 1-8. Secondly, the last chapter of Jeremiah, chapter 52, is very similar to 2 Kings 24, 18 to 25, 30. But Jeremiah 51:64 reads, the words of Jeremiah end here. That should be a quotation, not a
Well, add a quotation there. Jeremiah 51:64. See, the last phrase of that chapter is the words of Jeremiah end here. And then chapter 2, you have a description of the fall of Jerusalem, which is very similar to what you have in the book of Kings. It appears that Jeremiah 52 and 2 Kings 24, 18 to 25, 30 are derived from a common source that was not written by Jeremiah. There are minor verbal differences in the two accounts. Archer, who argues for Jeremiah's authorship, finds evidence for this in the fact that Jeremiah is not mentioned in 1 and 2 Kings. I guess he feels that Jeremiah would not have drawn attention to himself as the author, and therefore excludes any reference to himself, and that's an indication that he's the writer. Yeah, it certainly is. This is my next statement. This argument from silence, however, is hardly compelling. The names of other prophets are also unmentioned. Example, Ezekiel, who was taken captive at the same time as Jehoiachin, Amos and Hosea, Micah, the contemporary of Isaiah, while Jonah is mentioned. Jonah is mentioned in 2 Kings 14:25. So some prophets are mentioned, some aren't. But I don't think you can draw much of a conclusion from the fact that Jeremiah is not mentioned as evidence that he is the author. So there's little hard evidence to establish Jeremiah as the author of Kings. Among the literary critical school, there are those who have attempted to find the J and E Pentateuchal sources extended on through Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and on into Kings. This has little following today, although Otto Eisfeld is an advocate of the view. This pre-Deuteronomistic material is then regarded as restructured and added to by a Deuteronomistic editor or editors. The generally accepted critical idea is that there were two Deuteronomistic editions of Kings, one at about 600 BC, variously viewed as either shortly before or shortly after the death of Josiah, and then a revision with additions composed during the exile at about 550 BC. This view requires extensive separation of original material from later interpolations, details of which we cannot discuss here. As Harrison, introduction notes, quote, the extent of the disagreement among those who accept the postulate of two Deuteronomic editors is an indication of the basic weakness of the theory. That issue has created just an enormous volume of literature, analyzing Kings, trying to separate the original material from the later Deuteronomic editing of the material, what is to be considered an addition by this Deuteronomic editor, what is more original material, and then supposing there were two editions of this Deuteronomistic editing of the material and separating out the first from the second, it is really enormously complex material, the way that's worked with. But with a lot of disagreement between, everybody who writes a book on that has different conclusions as far as how, which passage is identified as what, that kind of thing. Seems to me of being someone in the line of the prophets. Now, we don't know the author is anonymous, but that's exactly what the prophets did, you yeah. see. And so, I wouldn't say it couldn't have been, but I think it's kind of unlikely for the reasons mentioned there. What was I going to say? Oh, well, in Hebrew tradition, that's why this Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings is known as the form of prophets. There's good reason for that. It really is a prophetic interpretation of history. And it seems like there must have been a prophet, whose name we just don't know, who pulled this material together and gave that kind of assessment. The most dominant current idea last paragraph, page 7. With respect to authorship, is Martin Noth Deuteronomistic History Theory? See Martin Noth Deuteronomistic History, published in English in 1981. According to Noth, a Deuteronomistic historian collected ancient materials, sifted it, and arranged it according to the principles of a Deuteronomistic theology of history. In his view, there was just one author for the entire corpus of material from Deuteronomy to 2 Kings. Deuteronomy. I see that really builds on the old Wellhausen idea that the Book of the Law found in the temple in the time of Josiah was the Book of Deuteronomy. It had largely been ignored or lost. But not just that, that it had been composed in the time of Josiah in an attempt to centralize worship in Jerusalem. And so that it really wasn't Mosaic. It was, Book of Deuteronomy wasn't really around until the time of Josiah in 621. But in any case, the Deuteronomistic historian added, in Noth's view, Deuteronomy 1-4 is an introduction to his entire history, as well as Deuteronomy 29-30, 31-34, he viewed as priestly editions, that is, of Deuteronomy, and compiled Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings as a theological presentation governed by the ideals of the older materials of Deuteronomy. This means that for Noth, 1 and 2 Kings was a work of a single author living in the exilic period. This author utilized various traditions and sources at his disposal to present the history of the monarchical period in Israel's existence as a nation as viewed from his Deuteronomistic perspective. In Noth's view, the framework in 1 and 2 Kings was created at the same time that the narrative material was molded into a unified composition. The author of the framework is the same as the author-editor of the narrative material. The work is thus viewed as a carefully planned treatise from the hand of a single author. Now, you know, with respect to that, there's no problem with that. The other aspects of his theory have a lot of problems with it, but at least he sees a unified plan to the book. And he sees the influence of Deuteronomy on the book. There is general agreement among critical scholars today that 1 and 2 Kings is a history work governed by a Deuteronomic viewpoint by means of which the actions of the various kings of Israel and Judah are assessed. While we may agree with this characterization of the book, it is well to keep a distinction in mind when using the term Deuteronomistic or Deuteronomic. In critical circles, the term usually rests on the presupposition that the book of Deuteronomy was composed shortly before the Reformation during the reign of Josiah and provided the basis for this Reformation. The ideas of Deuteronomy are considered new and revolutionary ideas arising in Israel fairly late in the monarchical period. See, 621, time of Josiah, is just shortly before the end of the Southern Kingdom, 586. It's only, 35 years. There are, of course, serious objections to such a viewpoint. The emphasis in Deuteronomy on obedience to the law with the resulting blessing or curse is not just Deuteronomic. It is covenantal and found in Exodus and Leviticus, just as much as Deuteronomy. And of course, what these critical scholars would say that Exodus and Leviticus, for the most part, are later still. They're exilic material. But so you have to, it gets very complicated if you don't accept the biblical material as it's presented to us, with Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy being from the time of Moses. Critical school, however, also makes much of what is viewed as the Deuteronomic requirement of centralization of worship at Jerusalem, which necessitated the destruction of the high places throughout the land. This centralization requirement is supposedly taught in Deuteronomy 12 and came into existence at about 621 BC. Now, that's a subject of discussion in its own right, whether Deuteronomy 12 really requires a single sanctuary. Only worship, legitimate worship, being permitted at one central altar, all other altars being per se illegitimate. I don't think that's what Deuteronomy 12 says. But that's the view of this approach. In the critical view, this requirement then became a primary standard by which each king was judged. It must be noted, however, that it's not so clear that Deuteronomy 12 requires exclusive centralization of worship. And in addition, when one accepts the general critical position on Deuteronomy and the date of its authorship, then one must view the evaluation of the earlier kings by this late standard as an artificial and distorted way of assessing their reigns. In other words, if Deuteronomy wasn't around to the time of Josiah, how could you assess the reign of, say, Rehoboam, first king of the southern kingdom, on the basis of Deuteronomy? If Deuteronomy says 931, how could you assess Rehoboam's reign on the basis of Deuteronomy if Deuteronomy didn't exist until 300 years later, 621? So, if you accept this position and the date 621 for Deuteronomy, then you must view the evaluation of the earlier kings by this late standard as an artificial and distorted way of assessing their reigns. The Deuteronomistic history writer must be viewed as more interested in his theology than in the facts of history. And his writing becomes a theological history in the sense that his theology requires distortions of what actually happened. For example, Wellhausen made the following statement concerning the division of the kingdom and the establishment of worship centers at Bethel and Dan by Jeroboam I. Quote, "As for their departure from the Mosaic cultus observed at Jerusalem, on the other hand, it was first alleged against them as a sin only by the later Jews. At the time, religion put no obstacle in the way of their separation. On the contrary, it actually suggested and promoted it." Ahijah of Shiloh. "The Jerusalem cultus had not yet come to be regarded as the alone legitimate. That instituted by Jeroboam at Bethel and at Dan was recognized as equally right. Images of the deity were exhibited in all three places, and indeed in every place where a house of God was found." In his Prolegomena to the History of Ancient Israel, page 458. In other words, the actual situation in Jeroboam's time is alleged to have differed greatly from the representation of it found in the Deuteronomistic history. This forces Wellhausen to question the actuality of the whole story of the man of God out of Judah who spoke against Jeroboam's altar in 1 Kings 13. See his Prolegomena, page 133. See, that man of God out of Judah in 1 Kings 13 goes up and condemns that altar at Bethel. Well, if in that early time there wasn't any idea of centralization of worship, which Wellhausen felt was required by Deuteronomy, and Deuteronomy didn't exist at that early time, why would the man of God out of Judah go on up and condemn worship at the altar at Bethel? Well, Wellhausen doesn't think he did. He thinks that's a construct from a later time trying to read back the theology of Deuteronomy over time, which a story like this is developed to suggest that this idea was an ancient idea, when in fact it was not. So this forces Wellhausen to question the actuality of that whole story, which he does. He doesn't think it ever happened. Elsewhere, Wellhausen can say of the Deuteronomistic revision of 1st and 2nd Kings, quote, "This revision is, as we expect to find, alien to the materials it found to work on, so that it does violence to them." He speaks of the facts of the book not only being judged, but also framed in accordance with the Josianic book of Deuteronomy. This was all done in order to give a theological explanation to people in exile for their condition. But this means that wherever Deuteronomic ideas and viewpoints are found in the text prior to the time of Josiah, they are regarded as secondary insertions and distortions of what actually happened. So much for authorship for the moment. We'll come back to it later. I want to come back to that from another side of the thing. But two sources. Because 1 and 2 Kings span such a long period of time, it is natural to expect that the author utilized various sources of historical material, which were at his disposal. The primary sources seem to have been a history of the kings of Israel and a history of the kings of Judah, which is frequently referred to as, quote, the Book of the Annals of the Kings of Israel, or the Book of the Annals of the Kings of Judah. Look at 1 Kings 14, 19. You get this reference used quite regularly. See, 1 Kings 14, 19 says, after discussing the reign of Jeroboam, it says, "The other events of Jeroboam's reign his wars, how he ruled, are written in the book of the annals of the kings of Israel. So the writer refers his readers to another source, which presumably was something accessible if someone wanted to get more information. 1 Kings 15:23 gives you the other source. As for the other events of Asa's reign, all his achievements, all he did, cities built, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Judah? There are 33 references to those two sources through the books of 1st, 2nd Kings. There are quite a few references.
They don't refer back to Chronicles.
No. It's different in Chronicles. See, their Chronicles is only the south. So when you get the book of the annals of the kings of Israel, that's the north. You can't refer to Chronicles. It seems like there are two sources, probably court records or something like that, that have been kept, that in some way were accessible and known. Yeah. The writer of Chronicles, pardon? But there are a number of sources mentioned too in Chronicles too. Yeah. And it may be that the writer of Chronicles had some access to 1st and 2nd Kings. That's possible. Because it's written later. It's misleading simply because of the title of Chronicles being Chronicles, and then the natural assumption is it's a reference to the book of Chronicles. It's not. Yeah, that can be misleading. The question, of course, rises concerning the nature of these two sources. It is to be noted that reference to them begins only after the division of the kingdom, and that presumably they were sources which began at that point in time. It is not so clear, however, whether they were the actual official court annals or some sort of history written by someone who had access to the official court annals. Those who favor the last mentioned view say that the manner of reference to them presupposes that they were accessible to anyone who might desire to consult them. And this could not be said of official court annals. Yet, who is to know how accessible such material might have been? It might also be questioned whether official court annals would have contained the record of a plot to gain the kingship. 1 Kings 16:20 says, as for other events of Zimri's reign and the rebellion he carried out, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Israel? Some wonder if that would be material that would be included in official court annals. Well, we really don't know that much about what exactly these sources were, but they're repeatedly referred to. For the history of Solomon, another source was used, referred to in 1 Kings 11:41, put a 1 there, 1 Kings, as the book of the annals of Solomon, Sefer Devarei Shlomo. Here it is even more difficult to determine the character of this writing. Some have said it was purely a pragmatic, propagandistic sort of work. Others say it was a history which contained exclusively a political account of Solomon's reign. Others say it was broader in content than simply political material. There are lengthy discussions on this issue, but no good grounds on which to draw firm conclusions. But there's another source, the book of the Annals of Solomon, that is referred to there in 1 Kings 11:41. It is highly probable that the author of Kings had access to other sources which he does not specifically mention. This is especially the case for material in Kings which one would not expect to be derived from court annals, as, for example, the extensive narratives concerning the prophets Elijah and Elisha. It is not possible to determine if material of this sort is derived from some single source or from various separate prophetic accounts. In general, most scholars are inclined to the latter position. H.H. Rawley labels these sources prophetic biographies. He says how many of these were used, we cannot say. But in addition to the cycles of stories dealing with Elijah and Elisha and Isaiah, we find the story of Micaiah ben Imlah, 1 Kings 22. But Osterly Robinson, in their introduction, remarks in a note, the possibility is recognized of there having been but one source in which narratives concerning a number of prophets were collected. This is certainly a possibility, but evidence one way or another is lacking. Seems to me, besides the official court annals, the writer must have had access to some sort of material that dealt with the lives of these prophets and utilized all that material together in writing this book. But we don't have a lot of hard evidence as to precisely what these sources were and how many of them there were. Thirdly, date for composition. The terminus post quem, and after which, is provided by the announcement of the release of Jehoiachin from prison in Babylon, and by implication, his position of honor there in Babylon until his death. We do not know the date of Jehoiachin's death, but in any case, it was subsequent to the death of Nebuchadnezzar and the succession of Evil-Merodach, his son, to the throne. This is to be dated in 562. So sometime, probably not too long after 562, is the earliest the book could have been written, because it includes that material. There are considerations, however, that have caused some to regard the final material in the book as added to an earlier original composition. In a number of instances, certain things from the pre-exilic period are said to continue in existence, quote, to this day. This is felt by some to indicate composition in pre-exilic time. For example, in 1 Kings 8:8, we read about the poles which were used to carry the ark. These poles were so long that their ends could be seen from the holy place in the front of the inner sanctuary, but not from the outside the holy place, and they are still there today. See, that's said in 1 Kings 8:8. After the destruction of the temple and the loss of the ark, this was no longer the case. We read in 1 Kings 9:20 and 21 that Solomon conscripted people left from the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites for his slave force, quote, as it is to this day. This, by nature of the case, applied as long as the kingdom of Judah continued to exist. But you wouldn't expect it to apply subsequently. The statements in 1 Kings 12:19 that Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day, and 2 Kings 8:22 that Edom has been in rebellion against Judah to this day, presuppose the continued existence of the kingdom of Judah. Other similar references are less problematic, but nevertheless, taken together, they seem to fit better with a writer who lived in Palestine in pre-exilic time than one in Babylon in post-exilic time. If one accepts the possibility of a pre-exilic work added to in post-exilic time, then the question is, when did the pre-exilic work come into existence? When one notices that reference to the source, the Annals of the Kings of Judah is cited with reference to the rule of King Jehoiakim, 2 Kings 24:5, but is absent with respect to his successors, Jehoiachin and Zedekiah, then there is some reason to assume that the first composition occurred in the period between the death of Jehoiakim and the destruction of Jerusalem in 586, or in other words, in the very last years before the captivity. The conclusion is then ascribed to someone living in exilic time. While this is a possible viewpoint on date and authorship, it rests largely on the to this day statements. An alternative is to take these statements as those of the original source rather than the final compiler of Kings. Note 2 Chronicles 5:9 compared with 1 Kings 8:8. 2 Chronicles 5:9. Says, these poles were so long, that's the poles that carried the ark, that their ends extending from the ark could be seen from in front of the inner sanctuary, but not from outside the holy place, and they are still there today. First Kings 8:8. These poles were so long that their ends could be seen from the holy place in front of the inner sanctuary, but not from outside the holy place, and they are still there today. Now, note 2 Chronicles 5:9 compared to 1 Kings 8:8. Chronicles was certainly post-exilic. Yet the wording is the same. The most probable explanation is that the chronicler simply quoted his source, namely 1 Kings. Why could not the compiler author of Kings have done the same with his source or sources? This would alleviate the problem of positing a redaction of an earlier book of Kings by an exilic editor and retain the unity of the composition by a single author living in exile, utilizing the various sources which were at his disposal. In other words, the to this day statements could be the statements of the source that the writer simply quotes, not that the to this day extended on into that exilic period. So, you get the point? Yeah. And if you don't say that, you almost have to say that part of the book was written before the exile, but with this last section dealing with Jehoiakim's imprisonment and release and so forth, that was added later by an editor. But a way around that is this suggestion. The terminus antiquem, and before which, is the end of the Babylonian captivity, 539 B.C., time of Cyrus. There's no mention of this, and no hint that it's imminent. The book must then have reached its final form prior to this time. Although this is an argument from silence, which often is not convincing, in this case, return from captivity is of such enormous significance that the author who related the beginning of the captivity would hardly have been able to be silent about its end if it had already materialized. In other words, it seems quite certain that the end of the captivity was not yet in sight whenever this was written. There's no hint of it. I think I'll stop at this point. I have another handout to go a bit further with some of this introductory material. We'll look at probably the first hour next week, and then we'll get into the Book of Kings.